The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It has been a tough summer in many ways. Terrorist bombings, police shootings, deep political divisions exposed by passionate support for outsider candidates, record droughts, and flooding. In the words of the poet, the world is too much with us. So what would it take to create another? Between 1820 and 1850, preachers, radical behaviorists, backwoods prophets, and salvation seekers tried just that. They sought deliberate separation and plotted their own versions of paradise in nearly 200 utopian communities across the eastern United States. The writer Eric Ries takes a road trip through several long-abandoned sites where utopian communities once dared to reimagine the future. His new book is called Utopia Drive. And Eric, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Great to be here.
Well, Eric, you hopped in your truck, you had your gas card, a box of old books, you say, shifting around in the cab. But you were driving into the past. Why go backwards to get a glimpse of what the world can be in the future?
Well, it's interesting. The German theorist Walter Benjamin had this idea of what he called the dream image, and it was this idea that there are things in the past that still hold real potential that was never realized. They're ruins or they're relics, and that you can salvage these things and then put them in a new context. And when you see them afresh in that new context, you suddenly realize, wow, there was something amazing here that just for whatever reason never got brought to fruition. So when I went to a lot of these Shaker communities and these communities that are now defunct, I was sort of looking for these kinds of images, these kinds of ideas, things that, you know, I think we really need now to adapt in ways to help us move into a better future.
Well, America itself was a kind of a new world, right? A fresh start. Why these years in particular, 1820 to 1850, when these communities sprang up?
There was a real religious revival going on that had very post-apocalyptic, you know, underpinnings there. And so people really thought they could bring about the second coming through their actions in this world. The Shakers certainly believed that. And then there was the panic of 1937, and so you had people like Emerson already grousing about how greedy and corporate America had become. And, you know, this is 1837, so, you know, you're looking at a really young country, and these communities just thought, we can reinvent this. It's not, you know, it's not too late. I think now we sort of feel this weight of inevitability on us as a country, like the powers that be are almost too strong for us to resist. But at this time, you know, these communities thought, you know, we can take the Jeffersonian vision of the Declaration of Independence, and we can just go off on our own and make it happen.
Well, you mentioned the Shakers, the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Appearing, the official name. So clearly
Right. They
were looking for that. Settled between 1809 and 1884 in Pleasant Hill, Kentucky, put up 270 structures in that time. So well established. The structures, though, were part of the draw for you. Why?
You just look at the Shakers and you realize that they were the most incredibly hardworking people that had ever, you know, existed in this country. And they were so serious about their vision that they really could bring about the second coming, this heaven on earth. And so they lived their lives that way. They built incredible houses. They were incredible farmers. And they built some of the most beautiful furniture, you know, that we've ever seen in this country. And on some level, they didn't even know that they were doing it. You know, they were like fish swimming who don't understand what water is. I mean, they were just breathing this stuff. And because they were so adamant about bringing about this kind of heaven on earth, you know, they ended up creating this beautiful environment.
Well, it was illuminating to me that they were real radicals in many ways. How did their beliefs depart from other conventional Christian communities, for example?
I think the main thing that radicalized the Shakers is the passage in the book of Acts where it says the first Christians held all things in common. And, you know, we would look at that now and say, well, that's straight up socialism. But that's what they wanted to put in practice. And so they did. They took that early Christian vision of absolute egalitarianism, non-sexism, self-sufficiency, being stewards of the land, and just absolute sharing. And they, you know, they put that into action. And so when the, you know, when the more mainstream Christians who lived in Harrodsburg and other cities around them here in Kentucky saw this, I think they were afraid of it on many levels because it was very strange to them. But I think they may have felt the hypocrisy of their own slave owning ways, and they may have seen the Shakers as a kind of scold almost.
Well, this was common to a number of utopian communities. Neighbors resentful or looked upon them with suspicion, right? I mean, where else did that show up?
For sure. They were really pushing against the status quo, and they were really reinventing what it means to be an American and what it means to be an American living within a community. You know, they were redefining individualism. They were redefining what economy means. And so these things, I think, were just very viewed with suspicion by a lot of people. And so, you know, we always think of these utopian communities as places that are, you know, have separated themselves off. And so we think of them as cultish. But I don't really think it was a cultish attitude for the most part that was pulling them away. It was a sense of necessity, you know, that we have to do this in a way that we won't be harassed. And once people see that it works, then they will say, aha, you know, there's a model for what the larger society could be. And, you know, to some degrees, that was true.
Well, people dismiss Shakers for their chastity. You know, the joke is it's not a real growth plan. But the Shakers saw sex as a kind of taproot for pride, for violence, separateness, power imbalances. Kernels of that kind of belief is something that you found in other utopian communities in other ways. How did you see sex and sex imbalances played out in other utopian communities?
Well, if you look at New Harmony, the founder of New Harmony in Indiana, Robert Owen, was a British socialist who was adamant that all marriage laws in this country needed to be repealed. And his thinking was that, you know, they robbed women of their property, that they were just innately misogynistic. And so, I mean, I think that was a very pure impulse to eliminate sexism there. And then you look at the perfectionist community in Oneida, New York, and they're kind of like the flip side of the Shakers. Instead of having no sex, they became a free love community, which in its own way freed women to choose the partners they wanted, to participate or not participate in sex. They practiced birth control. And then if you look at a community like Twin Oaks, which still exists today in Louisa, Virginia, you see the same kinds of anti-sexist policies. There's absolutely no domestic violence there. There's just absolute equality among the sexes. And so I think this has been a real linchpin of the utopian movement.
Well, you mentioned Robert Owen in New Harmony, Indiana, not motivated necessarily by Christianity. Very strategic guy, a wealthy industrialist who came up with this plan for a village of unity, which was established in Indiana. So what worked and what didn't pan out in this, the country's first secular experimental utopia?
Actually, nothing really worked at New Harmony. Owen did almost everything wrong. He sent out an open invitation for anybody to join who wanted to. So, you know, he ended up with a lot of people who just wanted to sponge off his wealth. He was very rigid in his top-down thinking. He wasn't there a lot of the time. He was out recruiting new members, and it just completely fell apart. It's like everything the Shakers did right, their industriousness, you know, New Harmony did wrong. And after 2 years, it was a complete disaster. He'd lost half of his wealth, and he went off to Mexico to try it again there.
One of the local newspapers called it one great brothel. But they did establish the first free public school in the country for boys and girls, right?
Owen fancied himself as a real expert in the field of education, and he brought in Michael McClure, who also had very radical ideas about education, and so they did. They established the first public schools in the country.
We're taking a tour of some American utopias, these communities of separateness which emerged and thrived briefly in the American experiment. Eric Ries is with us. He took a road trip to several and wrote about it in his book, Utopia Drive. Well, Owen, he had rigid conviction, righteousness in his method. There was little room for variance or doubt or management, as you're pointing out. But you also visited the oldest existing egalitarian community in the U.S. So tell us a little bit about the origins of the place, Twin Oaks.
Twin Oaks was started in 1967, the year I was born, Summer of Love. And they struck upon a sort of cottage industry model, which has been effective for a lot of the communities that still exist, in which they produce one thing for the outside world, as it were. And for Twin Oaks, it turned out to be hammocks. And they got a contract with Pier 1, making hammocks for Pier 1. And so, you know, you have this amazing, you know, capitalist exchange going on where, you know, Twin Oaks is bringing in a lot of money and they're building a lot of new dorms. And it's just this highly functional society. And yet it, internally it's functioning on a completely socialist, anarchist, worker-owned model. And yet externally there's this contact with Pier 1. And so you see that in other communities that have survived, is that there's this sort of one attachment to the outside world. But I honestly think Twin Oaks, it already has lost its Pier 1 contract, but even if it quit making hammocks and selling them on the web, I think it's such a self-sufficient society that it would continue on.
Yeah, but people don't stay there that long, do they?
Well, some do. I interviewed people that had been there for 30 years. And then, you know, a lot of times, you know, kids out of college searching for some kind of meaning, and they come there looking for it there, and they maybe find it for a little while and then move on. So I think that's one of the things I realized about these communities, is I was thinking of them in terms of like the Shakers, who just were very structured and they lasted for 100 years and people were born and they died there. And that's not really the way these egalitarian communities are today. They're much more fluid. Their values stay the same, you know, and the people who were there, you know, follow that set of values. But they do. They are certainly more fluid today than in the days of the Shakers.
So your wife joked before you left that you better come back. She might lose you to a utopia. Could you imagine yourself living in one of these places?
Intellectually, I can imagine myself living at Twin Oaks. I say in the book that they embody the values that I aspire to much better than I embody them. You know, I do believe in worker-owned companies like they have, and I do believe in self-sufficient communities. And, you know, I even believe in their idea of not having any money within the community, you know, a completely egalitarian place. But I think ultimately for me, I just need a little too much of my own space to belong to a community like Twin Oaks.
Eric Ries, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Eric Ries, he teaches writing at the University of Kentucky. He's an environmental journalist and author of several books, most recently Utopia Drive. You can find a link to read more on his work at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A sense of belonging draws people into a community. In the comic book universe, it's a love of heroic epics and villains, action and fantasy that unites readers. But for women, it's hard to fall in with fans of stories and images fueled by sexism and objectification. Producer Frances Harlow brings us the story of two fans finding their respective places.
Bevan Lucas sits at a long folding table covered with her artwork. In one print, a scrawny, angular Batman wears only a signature mask and a Speedo. We're in a basement-level conference room filled with booths for Maine's first-ever Comic-Con. Vendors display stacks of plastic-wrapped comics. Authors give signings. Fans, mostly men, rep their Batman hoodies or X-Men shirts. Bev herself is punky looking and pretty with short brown hair and a septum piercing. She says that, in addition to selling some of her work, she'd like to connect with other women who read comics.
There was a woman walking around in an X-Men costume, which would have been cool, but she was wearing like white booty shorts and just everything was showing. I mean, she was beautiful and she could definitely pull it off. I respect her appreciation for the comic book, but I kind of wish she hadn't had to go to that extent to show it.
Bev's bedroom is decorated with Batman posters, action figures, and, of course, comics. And like any true fan, even her complaints are imbued with love.
When I started reading comic books, I saw that independence, that strength of human, not the strength of man. And so I'm still looking for that strength and that independence and that rebellion and that fight against evil. I'm not finding it necessarily with the female comic book characters, but I want to. So I want to keep reading and see if I'll find it one day.
It isn't just the portrayal of women in comics.
When I walk into comic book stores and there's other guys around, there is that kind of double take because I'm not with a guy when I go in and I'm buying for myself. I don't know if it shocks them, but they're not expecting it.
Because the reality is, Bev's in the minority. It's an entire medium dominated by men. They write and draw the comics, which feature mostly male characters, for a largely male audience.
They thought Batman needed a woman, so they brought in Batgirl, Batwoman, Catwoman to be the love interest for Batman and Robin. You know, the hero needs someone to save. Let's bring in a woman. All of the female protagonists have these like triangular hourglass figures and everything's really harsh lines. And I don't mean to be vulgar, but no one's boobs look like that.
So Bev doesn't wear a costume or a t-shirt. She's actually inked her devotion on the middle finger of her right hand, a tiny, almost unnoticeable Batman symbol.
It was kind of a prove your love. Like, I'm going to have this for the rest of my life. You're a man and you read comic books, and I'm a woman and I read comic books, and I'm going to show it on my body. Like, suck it.
But not all women feel that way.
I feel so comfortable at conventions because I feel like this is where I belong.
It's like Disneyland or Disney World. Being one of those princesses or something that little girls dreamed of being. I dreamed of being a superhero.
Back at Comic-Con, I caught up with the woman in the white booty shorts. Her name's Nicole Jean, but today she's Emma Frost from X-Men. Nikki's tall, blonde, and tan. She's also a cosplayer, someone who attends events dressed as a fictional character. And as unrealistically drawn as comic book characters are, she looks like one come to life.
Emma Frost, she wears white. She's the white queen. She likes to dress sexy, so I'm wearing a corset and very short shorts and a cape. She always has a cape. And of course, the X symbol.
In costume, Nikki's like a celebrity. People often ask to have their picture taken with her. And for the most part, fans love to see their favorite superheroes in the flesh and critique the minutiae of their costumes. The more accurate, the better.
I use straps so I could hold it up because if somebody steps on my cape, everything comes down. So I put straps in that and people were like, Emma Frost doesn't wear straps. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, she's also a comic book character.
At home in her apartment, Nikki's friendly and candid. She agrees with Bev about the portrayal of women in comics, that their outfits are minuscule and designed to appeal to men. But her concerns are more logistical than intellectual.
You don't even know how they stay on. They're just basically plastered to them. It's not possible to do in real life.
Because Nikki makes her own costumes. One corner of her living room is designated workspace with swatches of fabric, sketches, and her sewing machine. Like Bev, Nikki's inspired by comics. They provide a creative outlet she wouldn't otherwise have. Nikki says she's always been a geek, but she used to hide it because she's also so girly.
I didn't really have a lot of close girlfriends because they were playing with the Barbie dolls. I liked that, but I also wanted my Ninja Turtles to hang out with the Barbie dolls. I mean, it shouldn't be considered stuff that boys like, but growing up, girls like dolls and boys like video games and comic books. The stereotype nerdy girls is, you know, supposed to be more like tomboyish. I don't like that stereotype. I'm like, I like to be a girl. I like to be girly girl.
Cosplaying has introduced Nikki to a whole network of adoring geeks, including her boyfriend. She even has a crew consisting of Mr. T, fellow X-Man Deadpool, and Link from Zelda. But most of her fans are men, many of whom seem to appreciate her figure more than her costume. Still, Nikki says cosplay isn't about a strict resemblance.
I have seen Spider-Man and Batman of all different shapes and sizes. It's not realistic that someone is going to look like this giant steroid packed men and the women with their breasts that are larger than the rest of their body. Give people credit for putting effort into the costume and everything. They are trying to represent the character they love, and they're putting their creativity into it.
In theory, a subculture built upon decades of obscure trivia would welcome anybody who knows their stuff, which Bev and Nikki have clearly demonstrated, but they still feel like outsiders. And yet, despite taking radically different approaches, both Bev and Nikki use their bodies to show their devotion, creating a distinctly female space in an otherwise male community.
And that story was produced by Frances Harlow at the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. I've always found it incredible, but there are people who do work at ice cream counters serving up scoops to people all day who can no longer stomach eating ice cream. That is not the case with this crew. All of us here at Word of Mouth love discovering and listening to audio at work and in our off time, too. Our Overheard segment is a chance to share some of the intriguing and moving and baffling and frequently hilarious stuff that we come across. Today, Word of Mouth executive producer Maureen McMurray and senior producer Taylor Quimby are in the studio. Taylor, let's start with you. What have you got for us today?
So I picked a couple of things that are sort of Olympics related. The Olympics are going on right now. We've been watching them at work, which is sort of exciting on mute. At home, I don't pay for cable, so I've just been watching YouTube videos from the 2012 Olympics, which is great because you can skip to the end. But I have been catching some of the, you know, Olympic memes that have been going around, and I just wanted to play. One was just a favorite of mine. It's a couple of Irish guys who won silver in rowing. Their names are Paul and Gary O'Donovan, and after winning, they just did this charming interview with an Irish news station, and it's just so funny. It's
good
just worth playing.
Congratulations. You did us proud today. How are you feeling?
Hi, lads. How are things?
What's the crack?
We're in Rio.
Yeah.
The background might look superimposed, but it's very real.
It is, yeah.
Certainly.
That's all there.
Lads, listen, Paul, what has the last few hours been like for you?
I've been shooken off now, to be honest, since the racing. I'm a bit tired now and the legs are like jelly, but I suppose we did a bit of celebrating and did the podium thing and got to put on the podium pants as well, so that was quite nice. And saw the mother and the father and a few other people and took a few pictures and that. And then I had to go and do this doping control thing, so I was there for an hour or two trying to take a pee then into a cup for them. So and after about 10 litres of water as well, so it's full up now, to be honest. Gary's had great crack, though, anyway.
Yeah, he's been busy there. I was running around having a great time signing photographs and autographs and taking pictures, and it was all well and good, you know. We'd be fairly tired now. We haven't had a bite to eat since after the weigh-in. We had a bread roll with some Nutella. I'm fairly hungry now, but I believe they're on their way with some pizzas for us.
I love that so much.
Yeah.
It's like it's from 1938 until you hear that he's peeing in a cup.
No kidding. There's just something so, I don't know, they're just like super candid. They're just talking about Nutella and, you know, really just took it at face value and just took the time, too, to answer them. I mean, you don't get that sort of stuff in those like little 20-second news clips that you see on NBC.
Which is because they're not all practiced at doing that.
Yeah.
That's what I love.
Yeah. So that's the first one I have. The second is sillier, and it is from 2012. And it was somebody who was watching the Olympic sailing competition and overdubbed his commentary. But it's definitely a comedian. There's not a lot of information on the YouTube video, but it is funny, you know, because if you watch this, you know, this sort of big open body of water, and then there's all these little sailboats that are just, I mean, like, they're just kind of going all over the place. It's really unclear what's happening. And since I have no idea what's happening, it's sort of nice to hear a commentator who reflects that. So let me play that.
Yeah, there you can hear the Olympic horn being sounded. Signifies there's only 4 minutes left of this race, and it's looking very close. And
he's also Irish.
Very confusing scenes here. We don't know who's in the lead. Is that Russia at the far left? They're ahead of everyone else, ahead of Norway and Portugal. Some madman there going the wrong way completely. He doesn't know where he's going. Go back, you fool. You're not going to win any medals going that way. Belarus, there. Not so good on the water, it seems. questionable human rights records as well for that country. Very windy. There's Ireland in the background. Watch the f***ing head. Nearly got twatted with the sail again. There we have Team GB, led by Steven Spielberg. He's taking notes there. A couple of lads on the phones to probably wives and children or other film producers. I don't know why he's there. Is that the finish line?
I love it.
So this whole video is just, it's so funny because I have no idea what they're doing and it's just, it's perfect.
All right, Maureen, what have you got?
So I have some audio.
After all that frivolity, what have you got?
All this frivolity. I have one from a radio producer. His name is Scott Carrier. He's been an independent radio producer for many, many years. Worked at NPR way back in the day with Alex Chadwick. Just has a really, really unique original voice. And he started a podcast last year called Home of the Brave. And he's been covering the election, the presidential election. And he's gone to the Democratic National Convention and also the Republican National Convention. But what you really hear from him is that when he goes to these conventions, he has no interest in getting inside to hear what the candidates necessarily have to say. But he just hangs out completely on the outside to talk to the protesters and to the supporters to get a sense of, you know, what's making them tick. What do they think about the candidates and the election? And the production style is it's almost like you're with him along the way as he experiences the scene. So to get a sense of it, the first clip, this is actually how his latest podcast about the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, how it started.
Let your power rain down. Let your love rain down. Open the floodgates of heaven. Let it rain.
Welcome to Home of the Brave. I'm Scott Carrier.
So weird, right? You just you hear it and you're just like, okay, this is not going to be like any of the coverage that I've been getting from the mainstream news or anything. I mean, he is going there where he really wants to kind of get to stories that you are not hearing on the radio. And what I really like about him is that his line of questioning, he just comes up to people and you know immediately where he stands on issues, but you can sense that he genuinely wants to connect with the people that he's talking to. Here's another clip of him interacting with some people outside of the Republican National Convention.
Okay, you just told him your name, but can you tell me again your name?
Dan Stevenson.
And what's the group you're with?
West Ohio Minutemen.
And could you describe the things you have on your vest here, the things you're carrying?
Armor plates, AK-47, Glock 17, and mags, ammo.
These are mags here on your vest?
Yes, sir.
In front of a flag. And then what are these vials here?
Oh, them's just light sticks.
Light sticks?
Yes, sir.
And a pair of scissors? What's the scissors?
That's a tourniquet.
Oh, for a tourniquet?
Yes, sir.
So, this is upsetting to me. You guys showing up with guns.
Sir?
I think that's complete bull.
Is it? Why?
Because you're just inciting
fear. Well,
that's your
constitutional right. Nobody should fear us. We're good American citizens.
Why
we
shouldn't
won't hurt
you
nobody.
Look scary as hell, man?
Huh?
You look frightening as hell.
Well,
really
if I look
scary.
So frightening, how's come everybody's walking up to us, shaking their hands, and having a good time and
I haven't seen
thanking
it.
Us?
Show me where that happens. Show
okay.
me that.
Are you afraid of me, sir? Are you afraid with guys with guns?
Over here?
Yes.
No.
Oh, come on. You're from Poland.
I'm not.
You're
yeah.
not afraid of these guys?
No.
A little bit?
Not now? No.
But you know what, sir?
I don't know.
I would step in front of a bullet for this man.
Oh, that's just
for him
that's
or you.
Shit.
I'd do it for
but
you.
But I can understand some people
you
may feel afraid.
So?
I don't know.
Wow. I'm sorry you don't.
So there's a lot of that.
So there's no desire not only to be neutral, but even to incite. That's interesting.
Yeah, he just, again, you just feel like you're suddenly with a friend or someone, you know, you may not even agree with him and just sort of experiencing these protests and the mayhem as it happens. But you'll drop in and you'll hear all of this chaos and you may hear, I think in this episode, you would hear someone chanting, "All lives matter, all lives matter." And he will actually go up and pull that person out and be like, "So you were just chanting that. What's that all about?" And then go to the other side and people will be chanting, you know, "Black Lives Matter." And he'll just find that individual and kind of cut through the noise to get their story. It's just really remarkable.
Well, I brought a kind of, I guess, moment of zen. After the last couple overheards, I felt like I was laying down this kind of heavy audio about, you know, big issues.
So this is an art installation, and this guy actually started doing them in inflatable bowls, but now he's gotten really big, and you know, like this is at some big in Sao Paulo at an art museum. He's got three pools, and he just puts porcelain bowls in them, and they just move around and clank around. Somebody sent this video around the other day, and I remember, like, I know who this guy is. He was at the Peabody Essex Museum down in Salem a couple of years ago. He did an installation, but just to tell you who he is, his name is Céleste Boussier-Mougenot. He is French, if you can't guess, from Nice, probably late 50s, really energetic guy. And he was really wanted to be a musician when he was young, and he was severely dyslexic, so couldn't get charts and couldn't, like, figure out how to play stuff. So he has decided to kind of, like, find the music in the universe, so to speak. And at the Peabody Essex Museum, he put out all these live electric guitars and had a room with 70 pairs of zebra finches.
Whoa.
And they just landed on the guitar. So Taylor, you can play a little bit of that finch one. So that's when they all hop on, like all the finches hop on. But I just love the concept of it. In this I think is one little finch. He's got a twig and he's got it caught in the strings, and he starts fighting with it.
Do you think the birds, like, knew the cause and effect?
You know, I actually wondered about that. Did any of them find themselves sort of like, oh, I like this sound that I'm this, you know, or feel the vibration or something like that?
It feels powerful to wield an electric guitar, let's face it.
Well, and that was his thing. He wanted to be a guitarist. But he figured out a way to make music.
I love it.
Word of Mouth's executive producer Maureen McMurray and senior producer Taylor Quimby here with me for our regular feature, Overheard. You can find a full list of our audio picks at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Whales are highly social creatures and usually travel in groups. So a group of scientists was surprised to discover a whale that seemed to swim alone. Lily Sullivan brings us the story.
In 1989, Joseph George found something that he'd think about for the rest of his life. It was a sound. Joe was a technician in the Navy at the time.
We looked for submarines and that, in the open ocean, and we tracked everything we could.
It was the end of the Cold War, and Joe was an acoustic analyst. He had spent the past 20 years monitoring the ocean for anything that could be a Soviet ship or a submarine. But that day, the sound he picked up was unidentifiable. It was coming from miles away and louder than a jet. It pulsed with machine-like repetition.
We were going along. We saw this signal come up. So you take a better look at all the characteristics of it. And we're looking at this, and I was going, holy cow.
To help decipher what it was, Joe called an expert in another field, Dr. William Watkins, a marine biologist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
And when he looked at that, he says, oh yeah, it's definitely biological. It looks like it could be a whale.
It was a whale, but nothing else about it made sense for three pretty important reasons. First, this whale's path was off. Whales usually travel in groups called pods, but as far as Joe and others could tell, this whale was off course. It was on a different migratory path from other whales.
Some years he tracked from the Gulf of Alaska straight down to Baja, California. Then other times he'd track east and west, and then there'd be other times he would meander.
Second, its song was wrong. It sounded like no species they'd ever heard. The nature of its call suggested the whale was huge, like a blue whale or a finback, and male. But those kinds of whales usually vocalize at around 20 hertz. That's incredibly low. 20 hertz is lower than the lowest note on the piano. But this whale's calls were much higher than they should have been.
He started out at 52 hertz. We could pick him up quite easily because he was so distinct from the rest.
The largest whales, the finbacks, the blue whales, they're the biggest creatures on Earth. And they're also the loudest, by far. Their calls rumble and pulse at unbelievable volumes. But these same calls are almost too low for human ears. In fact, these recordings have been bumped up an octave, because a lot of radios can't even play sounds at such low frequencies. But we've also included the unaltered song throughout the story. Some people will be able to hear it. Some people won't. So lean in close. This whale, calling out at the wrong frequency, that is a huge deal for a whale. Sound is crucial. Sound is their world. They use sound to navigate and find food. Also, to communicate with other whales. Whales are extremely social creatures. They pretty much always travel in pods. And this is the part that is really different, and what really caught Joe's attention. When this whale called out, Joe could never detect any response.
Oh yeah, there would be groups, because sometimes whales will mimic each other, like with blue whales, but with the 52, there was nobody else mimicking it, there was nobody else like it.
And the whale called out again and again. Silence. From that day on, Joe would spend the next 13 years studying the whale with Dr. Bill Watkins and a team of Woods Hole scientists. They started calling the whale 52 hertz after the frequency of his song. But the more they studied this whale, the more questions they had. They couldn't figure out why his song was so strange, or why his path was so off. There are theories that suggest that other whales can't hear 52 hertz because of his song's high frequency, or that he can't hear other whales, or that he vocalizes like that because he's a hybrid, a cross between two species. And because he sounds so strange, other whales are frightened of him and don't respond. When a whale keeps silent, that's how a whale hides. One thing's for sure. In 13 years of tracking him, Joe never detected any response.
I'd always be looking for something else to see if there was anything out there like that. And, you know, through the years, it was the only vocalization like that in, I'll say, the North Pacific Ocean.
Despite his apparent solitude in the ocean, 52 hertz has a growing community on land. In fact, some people are fanatical about him. In 2004, Joe, Bill, and the Woods Hole team published a paper about their research. A few months later, the New York Times science section ran a small article about it. The article was called Song of the Sea, Acapella, and Unanswered. Andrew Revkin was the journalist who broke the story. Revkin writes about some of the most critical environmental issues of our time, climate change, energy, water scarcity. But when he wrote this article, his inbox exploded. He got emails from tons of people concerned about the whale. Not just scientists, either. General readers. Artists. The deaf community. From there, the tale of 52 hertz started to take on a life of its own. That's when people started to call him the loneliest whale in the world. The story turned from science into something else. Myth. And poetry.
Ode to 52 hertz. While monitoring enemy subs in the Pacific, hydrophones classified a distinct basso profundo frequency.
That's poet Kimiko Han. When she read Revkin's article in 2004, it struck a chord.
For 12 years, he's been calling out to no response.
And she spent a long time with the story, thinking about it, trying to figure out why it resonated.
I think that on a very human level, we can imagine that or even feel it in our gut. It's not just sad, it's painful, that isolation, having no one, being alone.
Did you feel like you identified with the whale?
Yes. Yeah.
She's not the only one. People have written songs, entire albums dedicated to 52 hertz. Here's one song from a musician named Laura Ann Bates. It's called The Loneliest Creature on Earth. An illustrator in Germany made a children's book. A few weeks ago, a Facebook post was shared 60,000 times in just a few hours. 20,000 people wrote comments. One person asked, "Why can't we help it? Another person asked, why can't it be tagged with something to rebroadcast the calls at a lower frequency? At this point, with all these reactions, it's possible that some people care more than scientists do. Kimiko doesn't think romanticism in this case is a bad thing.
It's not bad for us to feel so deeply about another creature, and maybe we can't feel that deeply towards other people sometimes. So this creature becomes a kind of recipient, or a symbol rather, that it cried out to a human since no others listened, that it knew no others listened or feared as much, that we think so and can bear sentimentality, that we listen for such opportunities with frequency.
While the world was falling in love with 52 Hertz, Joe, the Navy analyst who had tracked him, had no idea. He and Bill had started their research in 1989, and they put out their paper in 2004. Bill Watkins died just a month after they published it. Bill never lived to see that Times article. And Joe, living on an island in the Pacific Northwest, thought the project was over. That was almost 10 years ago. But it was only a few months ago that Joe heard that the story was still alive, when a filmmaker called him up out of the blue.
He says, yeah, they're on the internet. There's blogs and everything on it. You know, I never thought of going on there to look for that. I don't know why, but it's kind of overwhelming, really, at first, looking at all that and just going, how in the world? I didn't know there was that much interest in the whale.
The filmmaker asked Joe to help him with his documentary, a mission, really, called Finding 52. Joe agreed to help, and he'll be on the trail of 52 Hertz again soon. But as for the loneliness?
No, it's funny with that. I think the people who take a look and talk about the whale being lonely and swimming out there real lonely and so forth, yeah, I think they look at it more romantic. We joked about it here and there that he's singing and no one's listening.
Did you ever have a moment where you did think, that is a little sad?
No. Oh, I'd say no. To me, I look at more science, finding out more about the ocean and its diversity. He could have been out there by himself. He may not. Really, we don't know.
And why were there so many unanswered questions? Because in all this time, they'd never actually seen 52 Hertz. They'd only ever heard him. To this day, no one has ever seen him. Not even Joe.
We have no idea what he looks like. It'd be like looking for a needle in a haystack out there, because the ocean is big. You're looking for one whale.
Maybe Joe doesn't worry about 52 Hertz being lonely, but he certainly cares a lot about him, maybe more than anyone alive. Almost 25 years after the day he first heard his call, Joe is once again going to start listening for 52 Hertz. This time, he wants to find him.
Oh, yes. I think that would be so interesting. That would be like, the end of the story. But then again, I say the end of the story, but, it can open up a whole new book again after you find out. I'd say probably close a chapter. How's that?
In the meantime, whales like 52 Hertz, they live almost 100 years. 52 Hertz's calls have deepened a bit over the years, so scientists think he's still young. They also think he's healthy. At least, it's extremely unlikely that a sick whale could survive so long, migrating year after year, alone. So if he is young, and if he is healthy, then he may live many more years, swimming on the wrong path, calling out the wrong song.
That story was produced by Lily Sullivan as part of Transom.org's Story Workshop. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. If you like what you heard, we invite you to share stories and segments with others. We find that the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. Please keep sharing them and join us again for Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.